thewellnesscouch.com, streaming wellness into your lives. Download the app today.
You're listening to Wellness Women Radio with women's health experts, Dr. Ashley Bond, the pregnancy and birthing guru, and the queen of hormone imbalances, the period whisperer herself, Dr. Andrea Huddleston. They're raising the bar for women's health by bringing you the most up-to-date health and wellness information to live your best life. Now, onto the show.
This episode of Wellness Women Radio is very proudly brought to you by Dinner Twist. Dr. Ashley and I want to let you in on a little secret of how we maintain our healthy whole foods lifestyle with very little time. And one of those ways is actually with Dinner Twist. So they plan, they shop, they deliver everything to our door to take all of the guesswork out of having really healthy meals for dinner each night. I love Dinner Twist because they are a locally family-owned business here in Perth in Western Australia, and all of their produce is locally sourced and seasonal. So they are really invested in all of their suppliers as well, which is absolutely amazing. Everything is so fresh. Ashley and I both get the Wholesome Box, which is naturally gluten and dairy free as well, and is very consistent with a paleo type lifestyle as well. So it's, you know, completely consistent with, you know, the way that we want to eat and want to feed our loved ones too. This is also how I trick Dean into thinking that I can actually cook. So seriously, if I can do it, everybody can, trust me. And their recipes are so delicious. They also have other options apart from the Wholesome Box. So they have a family box for bigger size families, an express box if you're really short on time, as well as a vegan box too. Now, we would love to give you the opportunity for you to actually try Dinner Twist and realize how healthy, how delicious, and how fresh it is, but also how much easier this is going to make life as well. So we have a special promo code for you, and that is going to give you $35 off your first box. And that is WWR for Wellness Women Radio. So we would love you to try for yourself. Don't take my word for it, but let me know what you think. Without further ado, ladies, onto the show.
Hey there, gorgeous listeners. Welcome back to everyone who's joined us, and welcome to all our new listeners. I'm Ashley.
And I'm Andrea. And hey, Ash, just, you know, as we always do when we're preparing for these or having our, you know, weekly or fortnightly or whatever it might be, catch up. You just mentioned that you were looking over our stats for the podcast and all of our new like reviews and everything else that were on there. And these are so amazing and so heartwarming for us because we're definitely not motivated by, you know, our podcast stats or anything like that. But certainly the personal messages that you leave us with the reviews that you give us and how like high rated we are is just quite humbling, really.
Absolutely. It's just one of those funny things that we want to say thank you for because, podcasts don't exist without listeners. Otherwise, they're just, you know, a drop into the cloud space of information. But for us, I guess rewarding to know that we're sitting here at night doing these podcasts and that there's a reason for it, that that you find benefit from it. So thank you very much. But anyway, ramble. We want to just get into tonight's episode because I'm still surprised we haven't done this, but I think we've kind of touched on it, but there's been an evolution in the space of women's health in the last couple of years and obviously a big shift in international classification in 2022. So we're talking about PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and it's basically a severe type of premenstrual syndrome. And for any woman who's experiencing this, you know, obviously we strongly empathize with you because we see it through our clients on a regular basis, just how life affecting this is, how much it impacts you. And we hope today we can give you some guidance and just some insight into the different approaches towards PMDD and to know that you're not alone. And, you know, they're looking at somewhere between, you know, up to about 3-5% of women globally could be experiencing this. So it is significant and it is making an impact.
Ash, I think that the stats on that are actually so much higher. Look, I don't think that this is just because of the sample of the, you know, obviously patients that we attract who, you know, are looking for answers for this. But I think that because of the overlap that the symptoms that PMDD presents with, and because hormonal dysfunction is usually very easily ignored within mainstream medicine, I think that there's a lot of women out there who still think that they're just going crazy for a couple of weeks a month, or everyone in their family or at work is giving them a really wide berth for certain times of the month as well, and they haven't actually been able to connect the dots as to why this is happening. So I'm estimating that it's at least 10% of women at the moment. And a couple of years ago, we did a podcast episode called Post-Ovulation Syndrome, because when we saw patients coming in presenting with premenstrual dysphoric disorder, but around the time that we recorded this, there wasn't exactly the language or that diagnostic criteria specifically for this. So we were sort of, I think we even titled that podcast just with the most descriptive term that we could sort of come up with that described the PMDD. But now we have the terminology and we have a much better understanding of the pathophysiology or the sort of mechanisms that cause these symptoms in the first place. And if you've ever had PMS or you've ever felt completely out of control with your mood, your behavior, and your body leading up to your period, women with PMDD feel like that sometimes for 2 weeks a month. And it's like you ovulate and the clouds descend. And they can have such an interesting constellation of, like I mentioned, the mood behavior and sort of physical indications that happen in this sort of cyclical pattern, but they can be so severe that women can feel homicidal, they can feel suicidal, and it can dramatically impact their home life, their work life, and just their ability to I feel like a functioning human for literally half of the month for some women. Now, it doesn't have to be for that full 2 weeks of the month, but often it is for a lot of these women.
Yeah, and the thing is, this has often been misdiagnosed or mislabeled, hasn't it? Because a lot of women are diagnosed with depression, which is why it got recategorized under both a classification for gynecological diseases, but also for the DSM-5 classification, which is our manual of mental health disorders, and that's under its own separate entity. Under depressive disorders. So it's good now that's being recognized as both the concept of, you know, hormonal, gynecological, but also mental psychological, because it's having those kind of impacts. So, you know, once you get those criteria developed, it's really helpful because now we have sort of a framework to diagnose from, an opportunity to look at certain symptoms and say, okay, do we tick any of these boxes or all of these boxes? And if we do, you know, what pathway forward do we have here? So it's probably good to run through a couple of the core symptoms, you know, that are looking as a diagnosis for PMDD. Did you want to run through those?
Yeah. Okay. So let's break it up, because I like thinking about it in those three sort of ways. So it's like mood, behavior, body. Mood, yes. Behavior, physical indication. So with the moods, like you mentioned, Ash, it can be mistaken as depression or even manic depression. It can also be mistaken for bipolar disorder as well, where there's, quite a, a possible rapid change from, and I'm talking about type 2 bipolar disorder, where there's the manic and the depressive sort of switches. But if we look at the moods, it can be depression, anxiety, panic attacks, sudden mood changes, and dramatic mood swings as well. In terms of behavioral changes, patients can experience, or women who do have PMD can experience, like social withdrawal. I guess the behavioral things could also include outbursts. It can include things like really struggling to control the way they are responding to, demands at work, at home. Certainly can change the way for mothers how they're reacting to their children. And this is probably one of the main reasons why women with PMDD who are mothers come into the practice, because they can't stand themselves and the way they act towards their kids when they're in that luteal phase of their cycle, when, you know, the symptoms are most pronounced.
Which generally expresses itself as heightened anger, doesn't it? Really reactive anger outbursts. You know, I've had mums crying that they were screaming at their kids and they didn't know why, and it was really no big deal. You know, like a child just spilling some water and they've absolutely lost their, you know, load at this child and realize it's a complete overreaction, but in the moment they can't pull it in.
Yeah.
And exactly. it scared them. You know, I think that's a really horrifying experience for any woman to have, that they should have such a violent outburst towards anyone they care about like that, whether it be a partner. And it obviously has huge implications in that interpersonal relationship space too, doesn't it?
Yeah. Definitely. And then that's also as part of those behavioral changes, it can tie into, you know, having a decreased interest in any of their normal activities. So their normal hobbies, even just catching up with friends and the girlfriends and maybe things at work or school. And there can also be changes in the way that obviously appetite changes will put into that kind of physical symptom category, but the behavioral changes can be this overeating. And there's certainly neurotransmitter and hormonal sort of drivers for this, but just that lack of I guess self-control, or even just not even caring about having any kind of self-control when they are in that sort of premenstrual window. So they will have no problem going towards the really high sugary foods, the highly refined processed things with lots of fat and salt and everything that do give you that kind of temporary dopamine hit, because that's actually part of that neurotransmitter shift that they're just looking to fulfill, I guess. Yes. So the change in appetite and how they're responding to that is also, you know, a big part of that. And then if we look at the physical symptoms that someone might have as well, so what's actually happening in their body, it can be things like brain fog, joint pains, inflammation, marked breast tenderness, or what we call nostalgia. They can also get engorgement with that as well. There can be headaches, migraines, anything along that spectrum of all that, almost that quote unquote menstrual cycle exacerbation of disease. So it could be flu-like symptoms. It could be changes in their normal vaginal microflora. So they can have cyclical things like thrush or bacterial vaginosis. They can have insomnia, or also the hypersomnia as well, where they'll feel like they just have to keep sleeping, you know, for hours and hours on end. And there can be, you know, bloating, fluid retention, you know, abdominal distension. What else, Ash? I'm sure that there's much more that I'm forgetting there.
I think it's a really good overview though, because that pretty well summarizes the key points, because you don't have to have all of these symptoms. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the thing where a lot of women discount it, because they maybe they only have one marked symptom and maybe something that doesn't seem like a big deal because it could be something else. But you know, there is a criteria, and ticking off a couple of key symptoms coupled with some sort of accessory symptoms, so to speak, gives you a better understanding of the driver, you know, behind this hormonal dysregulation. And this is where, you know, we look at the approaches that are commonly used in the medical model. And unfortunately, most women are medicated with psychological drugs. Mm. You know, they're medicated with antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication. And that's because it, you know, was previously just considered a psychological condition. However, we know the pathophysiological aspect of this, it's more than psychology. You know, it's so much more than that. And there's a huge influence of hormones, there's a relationship with, you know, not only female hormones, but things like serotonin and melatonin. There's different ways in which this can present, and therefore there needs to be different approaches, different pathways, different ways to re-engage normal hormone function, re-engage normal brain chemistry, and that can't be achieved long term through pharmacology.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And I think when treating this, you know, with pharmaceuticals, like you mentioned, Ash, the normal go-to is that usually a combination of oral contraceptives, so combined oral contraceptives and serotonin or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And there's certain classes of those that tend to be more, I guess, specific for sort of PMDD symptoms. But I find that really concerning that, say, a woman has marked PMDD symptoms for, say, 5 days a month, and say they're put on SSRIs every single day for every day of the month when the symptoms are affecting them for, you know, X amount of time, but they're messing with their brain chemistry and experiencing all the other side effects that would come with, for example, SSRIs, including, changes in their interpersonal relationships, a marked drop in their libido, sexual dysfunction, all of those other things that can potentially go with it, including, really difficult, experiences coming off those sort of medications, because they are very serious. And it's also completely overlooking the main driver of this, which is a change in hormones. And I want to talk through that pathophysiology pretty specifically so that the women listening can really understand what is actually happening in their body when they do get these PMDD symptoms. And I also think that the use of oral contraceptives is, well, obviously just a band-aid, but I think it's actually putting them more at risk of these PMDD symptoms, and particularly later on as well. So usually, and this is what I've just seen anecdotally in practice. I can't, cite any peer-reviewed papers on this at all, but the trends that I've seen for women with PMDD usually have a very strong previous history of using combined oral contraceptives, and usually from a very early age as well. So usually this was early on in their teenage years before that hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis was able to mature. Then obviously there was this cascade of very strong synthetic hormones added into the mix there that's going to augment the way those hormonal receptors and that brain chemistry is interacting with it. Now, maybe there'll be research that comes out on that later. There's certainly unequivocal research that shows that taking oral contraceptives as a teenager increases your risk of depression and anxiety for life after that. So whether or not this is part of that interaction, I don't know. But Ash, are you happy if I just roll into the pathophys so we can understand this? Okay, so there's a few different mechanisms at play here. And when a woman has premenstrual dysphoric disorder, the first thing that happens is we get this really big surge of estrogen when we ovulate. And estrogen has to get to its absolute peak right in that mid part of our menstrual cycle, the cycle. And with that peak of estrogen, it interacts with serotonin. So estrogen and serotonin work together really, really well. That's usually why women feel really good when they're ovulating. It's the influence of that peak of estrogen as well as how that's, connecting with serotonin. However, for some women, that estrogen may be excessive, or the balance in the ratio between the estrogen and progesterone may not be ideal. And then when we move into the luteal phase of the cycle, which is after ovulation, there can be a drop or a change in threshold of progesterone, which is supposed to be made in much greater amounts than estrogen in the luteal phase of the cycle. Now, any kind of shift or drop in progesterone in the luteal phase will change neurotransmitters and as well how our central nervous system is functioning, because progesterone is a central nervous system or a neuroendocrine hormone that binds with GABA receptors, and GABA is part of our beautiful calming inhibitory neurotransmitters. So it's part of balancing this excitatory nature of some of the other or stimulatory nature of some of the other neurotransmitters. From there, when that happens, we then get this disruption of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and it becomes overactive, and we'd usually use serotonin to regulate that. So now we can get this change in our serotonin cascade, which will then suppress further the GABA activity, and we might not be getting that good GABA action with not enough progesterone production or progesterone receptivity. And then any kind of sharp drop or shift in our hormones, specifically a progesterone withdrawal, will then create this ongoing cycle of that. Does that kind of make sense? I don't know if that was a good enough explanation, but the takeaway there is that initially we get this huge surge of estrogen, which drives up serotonin as well. And then any shift or drop in progesterone, progesterone's only present in the luteal phase of the cycle anyway, means that it's disrupting the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So now it's affecting our stress hormones as well, and we're not getting that really good calming hormone or neurotransmitter action.
So. Perfect. And of course, flowing on from that, then you can start to see that ripple impact. You know, if we're altering function of serotonin production, then we're going to have that impact on sleep cycles, because serotonin is that precursor for melatonin. So,
exactly.
You know, this is why all of those symptoms seem disconnected, but actually are all fundamentally connected to the very same mechanism of actions. So, and then you're mentioning, estrogen excesses, and this is where we go into those lifestyle approaches and say, what's your lifestyle life, and are you, what is your lifestyle like, and are you exposed to, chronic exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals or endocrine EDCs, endocrine disrupting compounds, because all of these have significant impact. And I guess what we're trying to say is we're not here to show you that it's your fault and it's not a genetic problem. It's a multi-factored, multi-pronged approach, which is why one drug, one, hormone treatment is not going to solve this, because the multi-pronged approach is really what's needed. And that's something that I think your description, Andrea, highlighted very well there, because it shows there's multiple pathways being affected. And so, which is why when we talk tonight about how can you help yourself through your experiences of PMDD and can you cure it, we believe strongly that there's so many ways in which you can positively impact your body, your hormones, your health, your mental health, your pathophysiological development of this condition. And therefore, you also have the ability to reverse that. And I think that's something that I've always found really empowering about, talking to women with PMDD. This is not you. This is not your diagnosis. This is not who you are. This is a condition, and it can be transient if we make the right approaches. So
yes,
when you meet someone with PMDD, Andrea, what do you, aside from, going through standard testing, so what sort of tests are we going to do just to have a look to make sure we're on the right track?
Well, the first thing I want to do is I want to understand what the risk factors for this person were, so that we can get a bit of a pathway to then decide what kind of sort of testing might be really valuable. And the particular risk factors for PMDD is, and not surprisingly, really like past traumatic events or pre-existing anxiety disorders, right? So there could be some things that are already showing up that could be triggering hormonal imbalances as well. Is this person stressed? That's a risk factor. Everybody's stressed. Smoking and obesity, also absolute risk factor. And for some people, genetics can play a role, particularly if there's changes to the genes involved with dopamine and serotonin and those sorts of things. So if there is this sort of predisposition, if they've got nutrient deficiencies, so including especially things like vitamin D, zinc, calcium, iodine, those sort of deficiencies, and I also add B vitamins into that list as well. So those sort of deficiencies dramatically affect hormonal balance and therefore moods as well. And then the next sort of category, I would think the risk factors are hormonal imbalances, including thyroid disorders as well. So if anyone has a pre-existing thyroid condition, whether it's hyper or hypo, I'm always really conscious of this for them. Now, dietary changes, specifically a vegan diet, can absolutely increase their risk of PMDD. And this is very well documented and good, robust research that diets that are low in things like tryptophan, which is most abundant in animal protein, will increase the risk of PMDD. And the other risk factor that I see, which is a little bit left field, but is if the patient has got elevated histamines or they've got that kind of risk for mast cell activation syndrome. And some ways to see if this is playing a role in that, and it's because of how histamine and sort of estrogen sort of work together. But if their anxiety or their mood symptoms is worse with ovulation, or if they get things like headaches or migraines when estrogen is highest, so around that ovulatory time, and if their headaches or migraines are relieved by antihistamines, plus they have this history of like seasonal allergies and those sorts of things, then I'd want to be looking at you know, whether or not these histamines or the mast cell activation syndrome plays a role in this as well. So those are all of the risk factors, and I know that that's a long list, and you know, many people may fit that bill. Like, you know, they've been stressed, they've had past traumatic stressful events, maybe they've got some nutritional deficiencies, but obviously it goes a little bit further than that. And the tests that I'd want to be doing to confirm this is a little bit more subjective, and we'll get into that in a moment. But in terms of, you know, objective testing with labs, is I like to obviously do a thorough health check. So looking at, you know, liver, kidney function, looking at their iron levels, vitamin D, thyroid function, but really specifically looking at what their hormones are doing in that mid part of the luteal phase, because we need to understand the ratios between progesterone and estrogen. And are they making really good levels of progesterone? Have they ovulated beautifully and they've got, you know, progesterone levels that have come up really nicely, but do they have some sort of relative progesterone resistance? So just like you can have insulin resistance, is their body not able to use that and bind that to cellular receptors properly? Or, you know, is this person using that progesterone as a precursor to some of the other hormones that it needs, that it's prioritizing? And in the cases of lots of, you know, acute stress, for example. So how can we help that body to then use that progesterone much more effectively? So those are some of the sort of things that I'd be looking at. I'm sure that list is much longer than that, but that's a sort of general idea. But it's that mid-luteal phase blood test for looking at hormones that's really, really important.
Brilliant. And then we take, you know, detailed lifestyle history, just trying to nut down what it is in a day-to-day existence. And for me, it's always a good question to understand, like, perception of stress. So we're looking at those scorings of how someone views stress in their life, because some people have, you know, highly stressed lives, but they'll give you a score 3 out of 10. And other people, you know, by description, doesn't sound too bad, but their perception of that stress in their life is 8, 9, 10 out of 10. So, you know, stress being a perception has a direct psychological impact on that HPA axis pathway, you know, that cortisol production. So it may have been, you know, you probably mentioned it, I just didn't hear it, but you were talking about like cortisol testing, you know, just having a look and seeing how people are actually handling the stress in their life. Because again, stress is perception. And that's interesting too, being stressed being perception, because a lot of people say, yeah, why are some people really stressed and others not? Well, there was some research done in regards to PMDD, and it was an Australian study actually that showed that it was 83% of women who had confirmed PMDD experienced early life trauma with emotional abuse that basically altered their HPA axis activity. And of course, that then alters neurotransmission. And
isn't
I thought that was
so interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And obviously it's hard because, you know, we sometimes don't even know about those early abuses because they're too far into our, you know, safety box that we've locked away. But our physiological sort of set point indicates we're more predisposed to I guess the fight or flight freeze experiences in life. You know, how do we handle stress? And some of those will demonstrate our set point, don't they? And I think this is why many people can be exposed to the same event, but some people are far more heightened in their response reaction to those events than others are. And that relates to that HPA axis set point, that sort of regulation.
And Ash, that's so interesting because studies have shown that women with PMDD actually have lower levels of cortisol and endorphins in both phases of the cycle, so in both the follicular and the luteal phase. So we know that they've had that HPA axis dysfunction or dysregulation for a long time, and that dysfunction is really consistent and congruent with lots of different mood disorders. And we normally think when there's mood changes or there's stress, we normally think high cortisol. You know, you're in that fight or flight response, but there's only so long that your body can keep that sort of that level of hormone production going for before you, and just the way I describe it, before you fall off the cliff, right? And then you enter that sort of chronic state of what we used to call adrenal fatigue, essentially. But, you know, we now know that that's a bit of an erroneous term, but and we sort of refer to it more as that HPA dysfunction now. And that low level of cortisol is much, it's a much more difficult sort of state to kind of pull yourself out of as well.
It's also, this is also an explanation as to why, because some of my clients who come in that sort of luteal phase of their cycle, they desperately want to get adjusted because they feel better right after. Mm-hmm. And of course, that relates to the adjustment and our effect, our impact, you know, through the nervous system on the sympathetic and parasympathetic tone. So we're able to, you know, drive up that parasympathetic tone, which temporarily calms their nervous system so they feel more at ease, more capable of regulation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not root cause, you know, but it helps to reset, neurologically speaking, to rebalance for that period of time. You know, it might be a day, 2 days, 5 days, it could be longer, but mm-hmm. it's really interesting to see how it's almost like a desperate need. So I have clients that like are scheduled in to have their adjustments around that time because they kind of know and anticipate the inability to handle life. And they're like, whenever I get adjusted, I just feel calmer, you know, I'm more able to deal with what's going on. But we can't explain
totally.
That at all levels. I guess you and I probably say the same thing. Look, as long as we can, you know, influence the parasympathetic nervous system, then there's possibility that you're going to feel better. You know, we can't make those promises, but I think that's the underlying mechanism. That's the why.
Yep. And Ash, that is hilarious because, you know, I reckon that you and I are pretty well adjusted, right? Mm-hmm. And I have got such a short fuse at the moment, and it's just because I haven't been getting adjusted enough. And I know that. And Dean has also known that quite specifically this week.
He's like, babe, get adjusted.
I have got such a short fuse, and luckily I will be on Saturday. But, you know, and this is obviously just our own personal sort of anecdotal experience, but just life is so much easier. Right, we are digressing there. Let me but also not even at all, because this is obviously part of our, you know, very strongly recommended treatment strategies for this. Just to give you a bit of context, when getting diagnosed with PMDD, usually there's one of a patient would fit into one of four criteria for it, and usually you'd have to have at least 5 of 11 symptoms. The symptoms sort of are descriptive of what we've mentioned before, so it can be, you know, the marked feelings of being feeling you know, depressed, hopeless, self-deprecating, anxiety, tension, you know, all of those sorts of things. There's a big long list, and we might actually put these in the show notes as well. Or the symptoms are severe enough to interfere with, you know, social, occupational, school functions, and so on and so forth. So there is a diagnostic criteria that is used for this that looks at both the mood, behavior, and physical body symptoms as well, which is great. So I really like that they're actually looking at this in that sort of way, so that hopefully it's not just being dismissed as anxiety or, you know, that sort of manic depressive type symptoms. Hmm. Now, let's get to what we can do about it. And obviously, with all things, timeless health principles always come into play here. And these are the first principles always. So again, nothing's going to take the place of a diet that is fulfilling those nutrient deficiencies that might be risk factors for PMDD. So specifically when we're trying to help support neurotransmitter production, a diet that's really rich in good quality protein with each and every meal, I think, is critical. Obviously, your tryptophan building blocks, tryptophan is really rich in things like turkey and poultry. So, you know, that could be something to sort of start to include in the diet a little bit more for those, you know, who are obviously eating animal protein too. But, you know, just that diet that's rich in protein, good fats and fiber with each and every meal. You know, your starchy type of carbohydrates can be essential to help really support ovulation, but also support that adrenal function, particularly overnight as well, and to also help to regulate blood sugar levels. So I just think that's a good starting point from a dietary perspective, and then also keeping things that are inflammatory out of the system as much as possible.
Also indications as well that enhancing calcium in the diet can be supportive as well because of its relationship to the release of the neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. So these are things like I'll generally recommend sort of small fatty fish, so like sardines and you know, those little tindy things that's, what do you call it?
Salmon, mackerel.
Tuna bones. Like, so basically the calcium yes. through, you know, sort of fish-based bony structures. So the bony little fish that you can eat because you're getting a bonus there of the omega-3 fatty acids yeah. coming through from the fish source, but also the calcium support there as well. For me personally, calcium doesn't mean dairy intake. Mm-hmm. So, you know, calcium's found in other food sources. So it's about just looking at that balanced diet, but not driving up inflammation with things like dairy. You know, yep. cow milk, dairy is guaranteed to increase inflammatory responses. So, just being sensible about whole foods introductions to the diet where possible, you know, avoiding supplementation. If you can keep that quality whole foods diet, then we shouldn't need to have a bag full of supplements and mm-hmm. pills in substitute for quality food.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of supplementation, and while you're working on reducing your risk factors, maybe looking at some of those, you know, past traumatic events and working through that with a trusted practitioner that might have some supporting mechanisms for that, you know, resonate with you, whether or not that is talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy or whatever fits into your paradigm with that, while we're moving our body and exercising to help to increase those good endorphins, even when we absolutely don't want to, particularly when we have those, you know, if we struggle with that behavioral change in that, you know, luteal phase or in that premenstrual window. So while we're waiting for the positive flow-on effects from all of those sorts of things, we can be using supportive supplementation like St. John's wort. Just use caution with that because it can interfere with oral contraceptives. Magnesium is absolutely the first starting point for everybody because that is your precursor to serotonin as well. Mm. So absolutely, like a really good quality magnesium. For some patients, I very carefully use something called 5-HTP, which is a precursor to tryptophan, or you know, it's kind of helps to essentially, it is the precursor to serotonin as a derivative of tryptophan. Vitex is used very traditionally for PMDD or premenstrual symptoms. However, use this with absolute caution because if you are worse around ovulation, this is contraindicated in my opinion. So you just need to make sure that you're working with someone who knows what they're doing if you're using sort of traditional herbs. If vitamin D is low, that has been shown to increase your risk of PMS and PMDD. So, you know, really looking at those factors to see if those need to be included as well.
And low zinc, B6 and iron all contribute absolutely. To, you know, production of neurotransmitters. So, yes. you know, if you're iron deficient, then it's going to exacerbate any psychological situation. So for me, just basic baselines, checking in on those sort of pro-regulatory, low inflammatory responses in the body, really important. I also, you know, tend to think that for me personally, gaining the tools and strategies to be more adaptive in our HPA mm-hmm. axis. So mm-hmm. this is our mood, emotion regulation, our stress handling, our stress management. So one thing is to unpack, you know, trauma potentially, but another thing is to impact the immediate effect of those traumas, even if we can't access them. Mm-hmm. And that would be things like looking at breath work, looking at the opportunity to, you know, do guided meditation, to join sort of practices such as yoga, where we can, you know, move our bodies and calm our minds simultaneously while enhancing, you know, breath function as well. I found that, you know, some women respond beautifully to things like Tai Chi, really, you know, gentle, calming, centered, present time conscious yes. actions, which is really important to balance those neurotransmitters. And this is also where, like, we talk about hormonal dysfunction in general, understanding your body well enough. There's often this discussion that exercise helps drive up endorphins and, you know, improve the happy hormones in the brain. But women who are depleted, you know, exercise can drain the battery further. So we're always, you know, conscious of when we say exercise, what we mean is exercise appropriate to where you are in your health state at this point in time. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you need restorative exercise, walking, yoga, meditation, mindfulness, Tai Chi, possibly some light sort of exercise like swimming. And then And there is then obviously exercise that your bucket's full, you feel better with exercise, so you can go harder. You can add in the cardio, you can add in the weights, you can add in, you know, the HIIT workouts and things like that. So really understanding that exercise is specific to you and your status at this point in time, because I find a lot of men go, I've been told to exercise, and it's absolutely burning them out.
Yeah.
Because they're just doing what we traditionally know. Oh, doctor told me I have to go for a run. So they're pushing themselves. They're pushing themselves, but it's actually making things worse.
So think of energy building movements. I like that. So ultimately, this is addressing the stresses, correct the nutritional deficiencies, use targeted appropriate supplementation where appropriate. The thing I forgot to mention before is reducing histamines if that's part of that sort of risk factor for you. And also it's so worthwhile having those hormones checked and working on ways to balance those, because PMDD is not something that you will have for life. It's not something that you should have to suffer with ongoing. Usually we can get really good changes within sort of hopefully within well and truly 3 months. So with, you know, after three menstrual cycles, so that we're really changing that hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis from one ovary to the next and back to the original one again. And sometimes for women, it happens much sooner than that. But we also just want to be really realistic and just tell them that, you know, you need to allow a minimum of 3 months before you might notice changes.
Brilliant.
I'm just starting to ramble now, Ash, but
I think that's a great wrap up. And ladies, if you are struggling with this and you need help, obviously Dr. Andrew is your go-to there. So don't hesitate to get in touch with her. She does consultations both, you know, through telehealth and in person in Fremantle in Western Australia. So if you need support, this is where you go. You know, these are the people you need to see, people like her who do this work day in, day out, qualified to do so, and, you know, are authoritative in regards to the research and the latest evidence in prescription and management. So,
That's such a lovely plug. But also, I also think that they should be seeing you too, right?
No, but credit where it's due, right? This is your jam. So, for me personally, I refer to you because I'm focused on my chiropractic, you know, practice at this point in time. But it is a pleasure working with women who can see hope and possibility when they realise that they're not alone, that there are alternatives to this, you know, standard guidance they've been given. And that once they start to address some of these underlying triggers or risk factors, they're already feeling more empowered, more in control, and more able to change their reactions and responses, and just, you know, feel more connected back to themselves, you know, improve their relationships, their relationships with their children, their partners, their family, their colleagues. I think that's the thing I see most is the damaged relationships. Yeah. And therefore that, you know, psychosocial damage is a ripple through society, because every woman has a role to play in the fabric of the village that she lives in. And,
I love that.
You know, well women means well community. So get help for this, please. And if you know someone suffering, if you have a girlfriend, if, you know, someone you know is suffering with this, please pass this information on. Please refer them to this podcast, you know, send them a link to download and listen, just so they realize that they're not alone. There is something they can do, and we're here to help.
Yep. And also that they're not going crazy. And Ash, I wasn't giggling while you were talking just then. Loki was sneezing in the background, and it was so cute.
So it's got Pete sneezing. I'm like, oh my gosh, there we go. And now it's got Loki. So the men in the house are allergic to our topic tonight.
My little dingo pup. So you might have heard that little sneeze just a couple of minutes ago. That was hilarious. Anyway, right. So, ladies, that is hopefully a really good summation of premenstrual dysphoric disorder, or PMDD. You've been listening to Wellness Women Radio. We are the Wellness Women, Dr. Ashley Bond and Dr. Andrea Huddleston. We are raising the bar for women's health. And until next week, be well.
This has been a production of TheWellnessCouch.com. Check us out on Facebook and join in the conversation on Facebook.com/TheWellnessCouch. Subscribe to each show on iTunes and check us out on Twitter. The Wellness Couch, streaming wellness into your lives.
Whilst the Wellness Couch presenters endeavor to provide accurate and helpful information to their listeners, these podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Wellness Couch podcasts.